This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking about the issue of separation of church and state today with Reverend Paul Unger and Judith Unger. Judith is a social worker and has taught social work as well as practiced it. And Paul Unger is a Methodist minister, retired now, who was director of the Wesley Foundation and pastor of Wesley Church. When was that, Paul?
77 to 85.
And since then, what have you done?
I was district superintendent for the then Peoria District of the United Methodist Church at Wycliffe the Bishop. And then I started a new church on the east side, East Peoria, and served my last year, 9 years, as a founding pastor of Willow Hill United Methodist Church.
Yeah. And Judith, where have you practiced social work in your career?
Well, I've primarily done either psychiatric or hospital-based social work, including Burnham Hospital here in Champaign-Urbana, and then went on to teach at Western Illinois University in the social work program there.
And what did you teach?
Primarily practice courses, and then I was director of field education there.
So you saw a lot of students go out to many different kinds of social work positions.
Sure did, yeah, and then followed them through that experience. Mm-hmm.
And, well, let's go to Paul. Why are you interested in the whole issue of separation in church and state? You're going to be on this panel that's coming up at Wesley Foundation this coming Thursday, September 15 at 7 at night with former Governor Jim Edgar and a professor from the law school. Why are you interested in, why did you get interested in this whole issue of church and state relations?
When I was founding a new church, early 1990s, did a study seminar that included going to Glendale, Arizona. The church there in Glendale was an evangelical Lutheran Church of America, mainline church, and the church, Community Church of Joy. They had established at that time what they called the Joy Foundation. And it was a faith-based program related to the church, but it had its own 501c3 tax-exempt status.
From the
government. Had its own mission statement. And I was fascinated because it was sort of my first experience with it.
And what did they do? What did they get money from the government to do?
They had schools, kids' country preschool, daycare. They had a youth center. Since then, they have a banquet and conference center and a library, performing arts center, amphitheater, parks, gardens, and lakes. And I was just amazed that a church could multiply its ministry that way and thought I should look at that as a new pastor when I came back to my territory. I had a conference with the mayor, and the mayor wasn't much interested in that, and I think he did us a favor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, so at first you were enthused. You thought here's a model that perhaps could be followed.
Yeah.
But as you say now, you're glad you didn't do it.
Why is that? Well, I think while they did it well, and if you were going to do it, you should do it the way they did it. The keeping of boundaries between church and state is just too delicate and difficult. And that it's the word I often use is co-opt. Co-op. It's too easy to slide over into somebody else's turf and to want to use their money for our ministries or for the state to co-opt the church in such a way as to want to use the church to slough off on their responsibilities. It's just that boundary keeping that I think has made it too difficult to maintain the integrity of church use of state funds.
Hmm. Now, Judith, your perspective is very different in terms of being a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here you've been married to this Methodist minister and a district superintendent guy for all these years, but you've been a practicing social worker. And what was your take on this when when the current administration immediately starts saying, oh, we've got all these churches that we could work with?
Well, frankly, it made me a little bit nervous. I do know that there's a wide scope of these faith-based kind of funding opportunities, and so I'm not saying none of them are appropriate. Certainly in social work, we work with a lot of agencies that are religiously affiliated, Catholic Social Service or Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Service, a lot of United Methodist agencies like Babyfold, Cunningham here
Cunningham
in town.
Cunningham Children's Home.
Yeah.
Have done wonderful work.
Wonderful work. But the concern is, I think, how the funding is used and where the control comes from and how the hiring is handled, for instance. There is some concern, I think, from the professional perspective of social work that people who have the appropriate education and training deal with very difficult situations and personal issues with families, and maintaining that kind of standard is very important. And so if some of those controls are lessened in terms of loosening the standards in order to use faith-based agencies, then there's some concern about the protection for families and children.
Hmm. Is confidentiality an issue?
Sometimes it can be in terms of what kind of record keeping and reporting that needs to happen. I think it can also be an issue with professions, for instance, like social work. There are professional ethics that the professionals are bound by, and if some of these programs are staffed by non-professionals, then those kinds of safeguards aren't there mm-hmm. for the public. So there is some concern about confidentiality.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Paul Unger for a moment, in terms of your role as a Methodist minister and a founder of a church that was trying to be involved in social issues, weren't there times when your thinking and actions would at least parallel government agencies that might also be concerned with, say, poverty or homelessness or whatever?
Oh, sure. And and in fact, there's no hard, fast line that can be drawn and kept. The fact is that there are certain programs offered by communities and by the state that you simply want to support and encourage.
Uh-huh.
It's whether or not there's the transfer of funds in such a way as to subsidize parochial interests. Those are the ones that our general counsel of the United Methodist Church says you just ought to be careful who you get in bed with.
Uh-huh.
We had a church in Smiley, Texas, a local church, a small church, trying to work in the TANF program for right to work, back to work women, and trying to teach them skills on computers and the kind of thing that would get them back in the workplace. So they took some government funding because it was such a good program. And the result of that was that the government was so demanding in terms of applications and reporting and late funding that the church said, we can't afford to do this anymore.
Uh-huh.
We've lost too much money. And they had to borrow from their own church to maintain the program in the interim. And then they said, we can't afford this. Maybe another church can, but we're out of this.
Oh, really?
They still do the program.
I see.
But they said, we can't afford it. We can't afford to be in business with the government. Now, that's a kind of a just an incident of lesser consequence of just the amount of paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
But it's indicative of the fact that the church and the state does business differently. And certainly you want to support the social issues that relate to poverty and oppression that address those. But you need to be careful about the funding of those programs.
Yeah. I want to get back to those issues, but let me take just a minute to reintroduce our guest to listeners who may have tuned in after we began. We're talking today with Judith Unger and her spouse, Paul Unger. Judith is a social worker and has been a teacher of social work, and Paul is a Methodist minister and has been a district superintendent. We're talking about the whole issue of church and state, religion and government separation, and, of course, this The catchphrase church and state also refers to Muslims and Jews and others, Hindus who may be involved with those kind of issues. If listeners would like to call us, this is a live program every Sunday afternoon on WILL AM 580, and Keeping the Faith welcomes calls anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet. If you're in the continental U.S., you may call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, you can access several local phone lines by punching in 333-9455. So for local listeners, 333-WILL. Welcome your comments, your perspectives on these issues. Well, let's go back to this problem of churches responding to human needs. And of course, this week after Hurricane Katrina, the floods in New Orleans, Mississippi, and Alabama, we've seen issues of government trying to respond to a crisis of human needs. We've seen religious organizations such as Salvation Army, others. We've seen secular private agencies like Red Cross, which comes from a Christian basis, but it's now pretty much secular. What's your take on all that? What does this tell us about how can, from a social work perspective or a religious perspective?
Well, I think there are certainly times in national crisis, as we have had recently, where some of the guidelines are relaxed some as people set the priorities as to responding to human needs. And so that's always a time when we relax some of those kinds of safeguards, and we depend on the cooperation of a lot of different agencies and organizations to respond to that kind of need. I think when we're not in the midst of the crisis, however, we do need those kinds of protections so that services are provided in a quality sort of way, and that individuals are protected and their differences are respected and responded to.
Let me push you a little bit on that, not from a social work perspective, but from the perspective of religion. It made me nervous when at the University YMCA, where I'm the director, last week, in order to respond on campus, the United Way locally said, we'd like a collection point there for people who want to donate to relief of people affected by this crisis. And the way they wanted us to do that was to have a Salvation Army bucket at the Y for people to put money in. Now, I know the Salvation Army does so many wonderful things, but I also know they're an evangelical Christian group whose goal and mission is to evangelize, to convert people to Christianity. And it bothered me as I put my money in, which I did, to think, now some of these evangelicals I know are going to be finding ways to do what they think is absolutely vital, which is to try to save souls and convert people, as well as to give them food and drink. Yeah. I was nervous.
Hey, I say good for you. Put your money in there. And I think it's a difference between short-term strategies and long-term policies. Mm-hmm. And short-term, I think you can afford to be soft and pliable and boundaries ease. Mm-hmm. In the long-term, it may not be what you want to build into your budget in the YMCA, a line item for any of those particular groups that you named. So I'd tell you to relax.
I'll remember that as we move to the phone. And we do have a caller who's on our toll-free line on line 4. You're live on Keeping the Faith with our guests Judith and Paul Unger. Yes, line 4?
Are you speaking to me?
Yes, I am. Go right ahead, sir.
Paul and Judith, my question to you extends a little further beyond the boundaries of the finances. My question is, when churches begin to sway government deliberately to their beliefs, and to a certain extent, this is financial. When they, for example, put out pamphlets in the church as to how they should vote in an upcoming election.
Telling parishioners, members of the congregation, how to vote.
That's exactly correct. And coming from the South, I've seen it firsthand. So I would like them to address that, if they would, please.
Thank you for the question.
I think that's something you should not relax about. I think that's a transgression of the boundaries that we've talked about. It's a violation of the principles of church and state, and I think would run contrary to tax-exempt laws, and have for at some points been challenged successfully that churches are not allowed to endorse candidates. They can – churches can support issues or oppose issues, but supporting and opposing candidates – would be the boundary transgression.
You know, I think this is one of the concerns with the issue of charitable choice, that there are agencies like Catholic Social Service, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Service, those sorts of church-related agencies that do receive public monies, but they have been very careful to keep those monies separate in terms of what those monies are spent for. One of the concerns with the charitable choice has been some folks feel that those restrictions should be relaxed, and that agencies are able to take those public monies and support information and ways of managing that blur those divisions between those faith issues in the agency and more non-faith issues, in terms of how they describe the services, in terms of having symbols up in their facility, in terms of the kind of services they offer that are religiously based. And I think that's a real concern, that there needs to be a division there so that public monies are used for public kind of purposes.
Let me push this issue just a step farther beyond what our caller did. Can you imagine a time when a religious organization would see a particular administration, a particular perhaps person in government that was so contrary to their basic values that they felt it would be going against those values not to publicly say, we got to get rid of this person. We should vote against them. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a time when, and of course we could bring up Hitler, we won't, but... Confessing Church issue of Germany, for example.
That's right, the Confessing Movement. Well, yes, of course. And then I think you say, look, we do this on the basis of our faith commitment. We expose all of our tax exemption.
Mm-hmm. We risk it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We risk it. Mm-hmm. We put it at risk for the sake of the conscience of the faith, mm-hmm. and we will speak out against this. Mm-hmm. We will even speak out against this person of oppression. And I do think then you put yourself, you expose yourself to the possibility, as some in civil rights have done, is to end up in prison or jail. Mm-hmm. You put yourself on that line.
Mm-hmm. Do social workers ever have that kind of a risk, Judith? Can you imagine ever taking that kind of a risk? Or do social workers as a profession, are you able to avoid that?
Oh, I don't think you can avoid. I think there are always issues that you need to be very careful about. And one of the personal kinds of things that I have struggled with as a Christian social worker is, you know, how do I live out my Christian kind of values but also do that in secular settings where I'm employed as a social worker? And it's not so much that those are in conflict, because the code of ethics of social work, for instance, is very akin to the kind of religious values that I hold. But there are some things that I feel I'm not able to do in terms of keeping those lines straight. On a very simple kind of level, I don't wear religious jewelry when I'm practicing in a secular setting because I don't want that to be a barrier with the clients that I work with.
So the cross you're wearing today is appropriate for you on Sunday and on the radio since
yes,
no one can see
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
But on Monday you wouldn't be wearing it.
But I would not wear that to work. No.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh.
Would you go to jail for anything you
for
just
cause?
Said?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we have a rule on this program. The spouses cannot question one another on the air.
Okay, fair enough. It's a good rule.
We're talking with Paul Unger, a United Methodist minister, and his spouse, Judith, who is a teacher of social work. Judith, when you were teaching social work, did these kind of issues come up in the classroom? Was this something that was of concern to students who are learning how to do this? Because social work, I believe I'm right in this, comes from a religious, in fact, specifically Christian history, doesn't it? The settlement houses in Chicago and so on.
Well, it certainly does. And a lot of the agencies are faith-based agencies. They're affiliated with some church or some denomination. And the history of social work is out of that benevolent kind of interest in, from those faith-based folk. As the profession has become more professionalized, I guess, there has been more of a concern to make it more available and more accessible and not to have it limited to a particular faith orientation. Mm-hmm. We do have conversations with our students. Sometimes they have particular positions, social positions, that are faith-based for them that may be in tension with more generic social work. Abortion, of course, is an obvious issue. And so we talk about how do you work in a public setting where you can abide by the values of the agency that you work for, but that you also can remain faithful to the kind of personal values that you have. I was a field director for the last several years, and part of what I would work with the students about is in selecting an agency where they would do their field work for social work in their final months of their education, would be to select an agency where they could be comfortable in terms of their faith orientation, but also an agency that as a university we could support in terms of the services that they offered. And sometimes we had to work on that a little bit.
Sure. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon about the whole issue of religion and government, how they are related, problems when they are related too closely, with Paul and Judith Unger. Paul will be part of a panel this coming Thursday evening at Wesley Church and Foundation in Urbana. On the panel is the former governor of Illinois, Jim Edgar, and Andy DeVoot, who is a U of I law professor who served as a law clerk for Supreme Court Chief Justice the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist. This will be a panel at 7 o'clock in Watsika Lounge on the main floor of Wesley Foundation, which is on the corner of, where is that, Paul? Do you remember still? It's been so long.
Goodwin and Green.
Goodwin and
Green
in Urbana.
That's right.
That's right. And if people have questions about the program, they may call Wesley at 344-1120.
Very good. Steve and I were colleagues when he was at McKinley Foundation.
That's right. I called that number many times, trying to get advice from.
We were close colleagues.
Well, good to have you back and on the program. Let me encourage listeners to give us a call if you have a thought on this, a question for our guests, either from the perspective of religion or social work. Do give us a call here at WILL. The number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Elsewhere, a toll-free number will reach this studio where we have this live program, 1-800-222-9455. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, and since we're about halfway through today, let me take just a moment to say a word about the University YMCA, which provides sponsorship for this program in part. Coming up at the Y this week is the first Know Your University lecture at Tuesday noon. These are free lectures that go on for a couple months each fall and spring. And coming up this fall, we start off with the head women's basketball coach at the university, Teresa Grantz. The following week, we'll be hearing from the local AAUP chapter, the American Association of University Professors, and people from the University of Illinois Senate, talking about who's in charge, the whole role of faculty in governing the university. And then the United Students Against Sweatshops, which is one of the university-wise student programs, will be our guests at a panel of students on September 27th. So those are the next three programs on Tuesday noons at the Y, 1001 South First South of Wright Street in Champaign, Wright and Chalmers. Those are at noon on Tuesdays. And then on Fridays, we have we're in our 79th year of Friday Forums. And this is a rich tradition at the university. And again, this fall, we have a wonderful collection of local faculty speakers and guests from farther away. Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, will be talking about her recent experience in Baghdad, and in visiting a prison in Peking, Peking as well. So that's September 16th, this Friday at noon. These are free lectures at the Y. You can have a lunch at our cafeteria of Thai food, or you can bring a lunch or simply come and listen to the lecture. John Brady Kiesling, former U.S. service officer who resigned in protest to the current administration's policies, we'll be talking about the conscience of a diplomat. The whole series this fall in Friday Forum is Conscience in Action, and John Brady Kiesling will be our guest September 23rd. Sam Hamill, a poet and director of Poets Against War, will be speaking Friday, September 30. Another big program coming up at the Y is our Communiversity, and we have all kinds of classes in religion and spirituality and photography, exercise and body work and dance, popular dances, all kinds of dances from beginning ballroom to swing to Western line dancing, tango, mambo, samba, taught by Miss V. So give the Y a call if you're interested in any of those programs, 337-1500. We have a caller waiting on our toll-free line, line 4. I want to get to that caller right now. You're on the air with our guests, the Youngers. Go ahead.
I am a retired teacher, and I would just like your opinion on prayer in schools, which is supposedly illegal, but which is done, and the teacher's role in how that can be done. I know there are teachers who prefer to give children a silent time when, if that is their choice, they can do it, even though it's not favored. So could you comment on that, please?
Question about prayer in schools from a teacher. Thank you very much for the call.
Well, I think it is illegal and with good reason. The fact is you cannot have prayer in school without somebody prescribing its content. And even if it's silent prayer, somebody sets up the silent period by their orientation and by their communication of that.
Do they bring out a prayer rug that faces east, for example?
I haven't heard of that. Have you?
No. It might happen.
It could happen depending upon the person or person's orientation, and
sure,
it would be as fair as anyone else's orientation. The fact is prayer is always possible in public school. It's individual. It's private. It cannot be prohibited. And so the fact is we have prayer in public school all the time. It's group prayer in public school that the Supreme Court has deemed to be inappropriate.
Judith, as a social worker, has this issue ever come up with any of your students, clients?
Not the specific example of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
There are school social workers that have to deal with school issues.
Certainly. Yeah. Certainly did have a situation where we were going to place a student in a faith-oriented agency. And as we moved toward placing the student for her field experience, they produced a statement that they asked her to sign. And it was a faith-oriented statement. And so we had long conversations about that orientation and the request that she sign that. And the compromise we came to, it wasn't so much that the student disagreed with what the statement said. It was the issue that this was a student coming from a state university and being asked to sign a very personal kind of faith-oriented statement. And the agency was quite willing in that situation to simply leave that paragraph out. And she signed the statement that we felt was appropriate, but wasn't committed to that kind of a faith-oriented statement.
Steve, the caller asked how to deal with it if you're a teacher.
Sure.
And I think that's a tough issue because you work for someone and you've probably got administrators who are saying this is the way we do it in the school. We know the problems with it. I think if I were a teacher, I would ask for legal counsel, ask the to refer if it's not possible to ask the administrators to check with legal counsel before, as a teacher, I would go forward with any implementation of prayer. I think legal counsel would be or board consultation to get it out of the administrator's hands and beyond them to the board or to legal counsel.
Since our caller asked about the very topical issue of prayer in public schools, let's move to another one. What about the whole issue of creationism and evolution? I was looking at the history of the university YMCA, and back in the 20s, in the 1920s, there was a lecture on creation through evolution given at the University Y.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. Now, Paul, as a minister, of course, you believe creation happened in five 24-hour or seven 24-hour day, or six, actually, wasn't it? 24-hour
rested
days.
You're not really sure,
yes.
Are you?
Yeah.
Not really sure.
And where are you on this evolution and the creation issue?
Language has tended to evolve now to intelligent design. And intelligent design versus evolution, there are those who contend that those are not contradictory, that that intelligent design has to do with who and why, and evolution has to do with questions of science, how and when. And that would be my take on it, that they're not contradictory. However, there's been a kind of a transition now in this issue of intelligent design versus evolution that has taken on the character of, okay, if we don't teach those as co-equal, we will ask our schools to teach the controversy. Let's teach what the issue is all about so that we can deal with the questions on an equal plane. Now, I brought just a quote from George Will. George Will's a conservative journalist. So it takes a special importance here when in Newsweek, July of this year, he says, "The problem with intelligent design theory is not that it is false, but that it is not falsifiable. Not being susceptible to contradicting evidence, it is not a testable hypothesis. Hence, it is not a scientific but a creedal tenet, a matter of faith, unsuited to public school science curriculum."
Interesting. I missed it.
Huh. Yeah. Huh. And then a couple weeks later, here come the support letters for George Will. Hmm. And I myself felt that's a good critique of the situation that we're in.
We have another caller waiting on one of our local lines on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, I think your recent statements lead into the question I had about perhaps social work and the role religion or faith plays in social service agencies. It's notable in creation science that, first of all, it is a negative theory, that it does not promote positive ideas. All it does is critique the current theory. So as as you stated so well, it is not a verifiable or falsifiable theory. But what I would also point out as someone with perhaps a broader perspective, it is solely based in the predominant cultural basis of creation. There is nothing to say about a cow licking the ice field or any other of the many creation myths that are in the world. It is solely based upon the predominant culture, and I think therefore it is subject to a lot of critique on that basis. Which leads me into the question about religion and social work. I have one that's a comment and one that's kind of a question. First of all, as a social worker for 15 years, it is very common to not impose your values upon your clients, but to provide them the services that you are slated to provide them in terms they understand. And therefore, myself, as a non-Christian, it is not my place to impose either pagan or Buddhist views upon my clients, but to accept them as they are in their context. And this brings me into direct conflict with certain social service agencies I worked for, where I had to subscribe to a Catholic creed, perhaps, and therefore make decisions based upon a Catholic creed, which I just found to be incredibly against the social work ethic, that I could not provide either abortion counseling or birth control counseling to my clients. And this brings me to the question I have. All of these agencies, whether it be Lutheran social services, Baptist social services, Catholic social services, receives large amounts of federal and state and county funding. And I think people would be shocked to realize that, like, Catholic Charities is actually a subcontractor to Department of Children and Family Services here in Illinois. They receive large amounts of state funding, but they still practice what I believe to be very discriminatory beliefs. And they express those beliefs in the way they provide service, and that if you, say, were a radical lesbian female who wanted an abortion, but you were assigned to one of these organizations that does not support the right to choose an abortion, you would be denied their support. And I just find this real conflict in that these faith-based organizations.
Let's let our Let's let our guests respond to that. It's a very, very important topic. Yeah.
Well, it is an important topic, and it raises some really good questions. And I think that's one of the critical questions to deal with when we look at this issue of charitable choice. And I know the administration, in terms of charitable choice, has been wanting to break down what they see are the barriers in providing services to people who need services. And one of the ways they want to break down those barriers is by providing funds even to faith-based organizations and not even requiring them to have separate accounts for the public funding that they get versus any private funding that they get. This really has become very difficult, and part of what is happening on the national level is that the Congress has kind of dragged their feet on approving a lot of the legislation that would incorporate these sort of charitable choice issues. And part of what the administration has been doing is trying to introduce them piecemeal into specific legislation. I think there really does need to be some caution about how public monies are funded. And I think agencies, by and large, when you take – you mentioned some of the larger agencies like Catholic Charities or Lutheran Social Service, they're very careful about keeping those monies separated. So that the public monies are not spent on religious-oriented services. Now, it is an issue with Catholic Charities, for instance, that they are not able to provide abortion counseling or abortion services because that's simply a statement of their faith, and their funds simply will not go to those kinds of services. You raise a good issue in terms of the accessibility of a broad-based level of services. And it's particularly difficult in rural communities where you have not very many social service agencies, and the ones you have may be very small, and they may be faith-based and therefore have some limits on the services that they provide.
Churches and social workers deal with people in all stages of their life, life and death, and dealing with difficult issues. And often the government seems to be, I wouldn't say working at cross purposes necessarily, but sometimes it feels that way. Churches may, or religious groups may be trying to respond, for example, Jewish Federation may be trying to respond to people in poverty, and what the government is doing maybe seem to make their situation worse, you know, by certain policies. How are religious groups to think about those kind of conflicts with a government when those church people are citizens?
I have a quote by Martin Luther King Jr., who said that the church must be reminded that it is not the master nor the servant of the state, but rather the conscience of the state. It must be the guide and the critic of the state and never its tool. And it seems to me that those are the boundaries to be maintained, that when you find the church becoming the tool of the government or the government becoming the tool of the church, those are the places where there have been boundary transgressions. However, those are always very delicate and difficult to differentiate. And I had a quote here by James Madison, who even that early said, "It may not be easy," James Madison wrote, "in every possible case, to trace the line of separation between the rights of religion and civil authority with such distinctiveness as to avoid collisions." And I think what you said is we're going to have some crashes.
Sure.
And it's inevitable. It's sort of trying to learn to live with the tension and never assume that the tension is not there, because it will continue to be there. It's built in. Should be there. We should recognize it, have some tolerance for it, but also have some accountability for it.
We're down to our last quarter hour on Keeping the Faith this Sunday evening, talking about issues of government and religion with Judith Unger, who is a social worker and teacher of social work, and Paul Unger, a United Methodist minister. I'd like to take just a short break and read a poem by the current poet laureate of the state of Illinois, Kevin Stein, who teaches at Bradley University. He's been a former guest on this program, and he has very kindly given me permission to read from his published poetry. And this particular poem is from his most recent book, published by University of Illinois Press, called American Ghost Roses. It's a collection of poems that Kevin wrote in response to the death of his father. And in this particular poem that I've chosen to read today on this program, I thought it appropriate because of its religious imagery, as well as the fact that it's written from the perspective of a young man growing up in a family of poverty. And we've talked about responses of social work and religion to poverty, and I thought it was appropriate. This is a poem of about, let's see, four-line stanzas. It's called Theory and Practice. This is written by Kevin Stein and read with his permission and the permission of University of Illinois Press. Theory and Practice. Whenever I find my mother baking a cake, I know someone's dead. After the funeral mass, her angel's food soon sweetens bereaved lips. Levi Strauss thought artists shape the beautiful and useful out of the dump heap of human life. He called it bricolage, using whatever comes to hand. In this way, the cook who's magic with leftovers practices culinary bricolage, and a nerd cobbling together computer parts exhibits technical bricolage. So, the poet of apples and oranges makes what? Fruit salad? Or should I take solace in Heraclitus's claim, "The fairest order is a heap of random sweepings"? Perhaps, though remember, he thinks the ways up and down are one. Which theory explains what I make of my mother's baking? Let me start again. When I was a boy, she peddled cakes and pies to pay the week's grocery bill. White-gloved ladies rang our bell but didn't come in. By then, one's read enough to know what urchin means. Now she works the church's funeral baking committee, doling her dished and sugared condolences to kids of former customers. Do they taste that taste and ponder their dead parents? Archilochus contends, "The fox knows many things, the hedgehog only one. One big one." Am I the hedgehog? Am I blind? Try this. Wisdom, Heraclitus theorizes, understands the thought that steers all things. His way of praising in theory, well, covert logos, the invisible cosmic order. In practice, it goes like this. What my mother baked went quick out the door to cool upon the seats of Cadillacs. One lady offered me a tip, not the usual nickel. "Boy, remember your place. What you smell, you'll never taste." Hers was devil's food. A poem by Illinois Poet Laureate, Theory and Practice, from Kevin Stein's collection, American Ghost Roses, published this year by University of Illinois Press, part of the Illinois Poetry Series, edited by Lawrence Lieberman. Read by permission of the press and the author. Well, a poem, poetic response to the whole issue of growing up poor and how people treated you. How does the government treat poor people? Social worker?
Oh, it depends. Generally not very well. I think we have been through a time when we developed a lot of programs, government-based programs, to try to respond to the poor, and then there was some backlash about that, and so we've reformed all those programs, and on the surface it looks like our welfare rolls have dramatically decreased, which ought to be the good news. But the concern, I think, is that we don't really know what has happened to those folks. And I think looking at what happened in New Orleans this week is maybe one example of where we find a lot of folks who were trapped in an inner city without any mechanism to leave. They didn't have the transportation. They didn't have the funds. They didn't have the place to go.
So they were surviving just barely, and
just
we discovered
barely.
How barely they were surviving.
Just barely. Right? Yeah. And so while there's some really good things about our welfare system, and I think there were some good things that came out of welfare reform, I think we're not there yet.
Paul, as a Methodist minister, how does the church respond to poor people?
There's a reason to think that the church speaks knowledgeably about poverty. And has a more difficult time implementing mission to poverty. And I think that it's uncomfortable because it's so clear that the New Testament, the Old Testament, are oriented that God's concern is always on the side of the poor. God's advocacy is always on the side of the least. So it's with some discomfort that the church, I think, maintains its separation from some of the issues of poverty. On the other hand, there are some genuine breakthroughs of concern, Habitat for Humanity, many of the mission programs that are now going into the relief in the flood areas, sponsored by churches. Mm-hmm. Worker after worker, van after van, caravan after caravan of church people going down to make a difference. I think it's impossible to speak with one word about all of that. I think it's probably never enough, and sometimes it's absolutely heroic.
Let me ask a critical question, which maybe our listeners are too polite to ask. Aren't mainline churches like the Methodists, like Lutherans and Presbyterians and all those folks, aren't they just sort of middle-class rich folks who just really are concerned about their own comfort and give a little bit through the church as a way not to have to think about the poor or know any of them?
It is true that if you look inside a local congregation, there's probably a great deal of identity by class, identity by race, segregation, if you will. On the other hand, there's a considerable amount of affirmative action that goes on within the church at the level above the local church sometimes, even in appointment making. Mixing it up so that we have the interfacing of races and cultures in such a way that that really does bode well for intending to make it better against all odds. But I think you're not unfair to say we haven't done that very well.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Paul Unger and his spouse Judith Unger, about this government and religious relations. We have about 6 or 7 minutes to go. We could probably sneak in one more phone call. In Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Paul Unger will be on a panel this Thursday, September 15 at 7 p.m. at Wesley Foundation, dealing with the whole issue of separation in church and state. You may also get a chance that evening to hear Jim Edgar's take on it, former governor of Illinois, now on the faculty of University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and Professor Andy DeVoot, U of I law professor. So that's available free. 7 p.m. in Watsika Lounge on the main floor of Wesley Foundation, the corner of Goodwin and Green in Urbana. Getting back to our topic of the day, we haven't mentioned the Ten Commandments. Surely these 10 basic ethical principles from Judaism, which had been accepted by Islam, accepted by Christians, surely, since our whole legal setup in America is based on those, there's nothing wrong with putting them in courthouses, is there?
Interestingly enough, Steve, I just attended a seminar with Jim Fleming, who's a scholar from Jerusalem, who says that the Ten Commandments really have not done that much to form our legal or moral fabric. And he says, for instance, take the ten, and how many of them are law? No other gods? No law. Idols? No law. Third commandment, taking God's name in vain? That's not against the law. Keeping the Sabbath
but
holy?
But please don't do it on the radio.
Honor your father and mother? Only when you get down to murder, only then when you get down to stealing, and only false witness if you're under oath in court. Other than that, possibly 2, 2.5, or 3 commandments are not the fabric of our moral code at all, or our at least our legal code.
Mm-hmm.
Our legal code. And so it's sort of like trying to force an issue in that has not been that determinative in terms of our history. It certainly is critical to our faith development. And that's probably where it ought to stay, inside those houses of our faith development in our hearts.
Mm-hmm. And the ones, the first three, can be accepted by theists,
of course,
which followers of Islam and Judaism and Christianity are, but not by others.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with the Ten Commandments, and would that we would do better keeping them. I think what the courts are deciding is that if they are among other religious statements, they can perhaps be a part of the fabric of that whole background of faith and conscience that we have.
Now, as a Christian pastor, you know that Jesus made those commandments much worse by what he said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5-7, where he talked about if you even...
In your heart.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
What was it Jimmy Carter said? Lust in your heart.
If you lust in your heart. And he confessed to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's in Playboy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's in Playboy. That's right. Well, what was your question?
Yes, it is an interesting issue, isn't it? So what are the other issues that we've neglected in this fast 58 minutes talking about church and state? We've talked about Ten Commandments, creationism, prayer in schools. Are there any other big issues facing either social workers or ministers these days in terms of the government either interfering or overstepping
boundaries? I would say chaplaincy. Ah. It's a big issue, and more than we can really cover here. There are certain exceptions made for instance, military chaplains. They're part of the military, but they're also part of their church orientation. Mm-hmm. And there are, for the sake of those who have to serve in the military, we have provided ways and means for those folks to be credentialed in both the church and the government for service. That's very delicate, and the issue has to continue to be that the church can always pull the credentials so that if they're out of line in regard to the church's orientation, they can still be pulled. Sometimes it gets a little ticklish about that.
There are also chaplains in the Senate.
In the Senate. Mm-hmm. Same problems, but some of the same tolerances that we've accepted.
We're going to have to stop here. Our guests have been Judith Unger and her spouse, Paul Unger, social worker and Methodist minister. Paul will be speaking at Wesley Church this Thursday, September 15, on a panel dealing with these issues of separation in church and state. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And next week, I'll be very pleased to be interviewing the imam from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, Dr. Mujahid Al-Fayyad, and perhaps one or two others, about the issue of Islam and other religions. Then on September 25th, Thomas Albrecht, who is putting a professor of art and design at the University of Illinois, who is this day, putting on a artistic memorial to September 11 called Call and Response. It's a performance art project. Professor Albrecht will be our guest on Keeping the Faith, talking about that memorial using art, performance art, for September 11th terrorist attack. So those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. I want to thank our guests today and our listeners and those who called in.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Thomas Paine had few prospects when he landed in America in 1774, but 2 years later, his pamphlet Common Sense had laid the foundation for the Declaration of Independence. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, why politicians ever since have tried to reclaim Paine's legacy. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, clear during the evening, then haze after midnight. The low in the mid-60s with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with the high in the lower 90s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with the low in the upper 60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.